Okay, hi, we're back on LA Lit with Will Alexander, and Will's going to read to us from Stratospheric Canticles.
And this poem has an odd history. I was walking across the street to catch a bus, and the poem started writing itself in the middle of the intersection. And I began to compose it in a feverish manner while waiting for the bus and after I got on the bus, and it was done by the time I got to work. And this is called The Mime Tornado. Whirling in this burning circular aviary, in this greenish stellar intensity, greeting the fire of my own shadow with its simultaneous spurs, erupting from linguistic ferret, from the black domesticity of arrogance like a wind absorbed in solar reptile signals. I greet its invincible ire in the penetrating flux of its harried angular journey. It is a syllabus of glass and of ants, roving like a living mutational turquoise, a lamp, an aperture of iridescent proto-diamonds, hurtling through rivers of swirling lunar hematopias, heated by blank Egyptian kindling moons. Here I am on a raft of instinctive gemstone tumbling, on a raft of rainy black and red molten, calling on my shadow with all the color emptied from its treasonous mime tornado, so that eternity ingests the force of blazing tourmaline invictus, invictus charged with the stunning topology of ignition, with the empty transmigration bodies taking on the momentous characteristic of the transmundane specific, unraveling the basic tourniquets of hydrogen, as in the songs from bodiless sunbells, the black sun levels where karmic stains are transmogrified, and the thoughts miasmatic like the name of a cloud passing into anomalous writhing. My shadow, the occult, the runic enclave, overarched like a beacon minus its wretched cyclical entrapment, a beacon in a floating citron granary, burning from its ubiquitous orbicular fountain, from its ironic wellsprings of torment, its oasis of gases, incessant, mutagenic, heraldic, boiling.
Okay, well, I've been holding on to this question now, and here it is. And it relates to many of the things we've been talking about, alchemy and precision and language, especially the place of language within this world and what it means to speak and to write and to sing poetry. On page 124 of my copy of Sunrise, or Matt's copy of Sunrise and Armageddon, which is in the second novel of the three. It says, the secrets of death have been existentially eroded. I can say this because we are part of this erosion. Even though many rituals are gone, even though animism has been banished by means of a dastardly clerical cleanliness. I guess what the current moment in my own evolution is sort of more and more focused on animism. And I was hoping that you could maybe talk about that, especially in terms of language and certain notions that somehow language is what separates human beings from nature, or makes them think that they're separated from nature. Whereas in animistic terms, this can't be the case.
Right. Well, it's part of a whole, and language comes from the whole. And so when you're separating or using the language as a means of separation, you're creating a conscious portion of language that is, for want of a better term, metered and structured so as to have a certain kind of separative effect, as if language could only produce a certain kind of or represent or describe a product or a noun. Whereas in an animistic universe, everything is alive. The words you say, the wind you feel, you know, the stars that you see, it's all a concertizing. Animism is a concertizing element. And so all the parts are together in one degree or another. It's completely in rhythm at all times. And by the way, we are in a state now where we use language to separate ourselves from nature, but in the original sense, poetry was the first language of nature, or is the first language of nature. And it is nature, to be more precise. It is part of nature. So, you know, André Breton says something about, you know, man, you know, man sometimes speaks. And I think that's what he was talking about. You really speak in the terms of the way that wind blows or the way that, you know, the sun functions. That to me is what is called God, that we call God on this plane. But it's pretty intense, because if there's volcanoes on Io, nobody put them there. And there's volcanoes on Earth, and nobody put those there. No advertiser is responsible for that. But the way language is used, we feel as though that someone had put the volcano here and made it erupt, and then because we're reporting it to you that it's doing this. But that's I call it, that's quotidian hypnotism.
Well, anybody else have questions? Any you guys out there? Aaron? Yeah. Okay.
What you were just saying reminded me of a problem in the Ames film Powers of Ten. You know, like where every time there's an edit, you're on a completely different scale. Like so it's like there's a shot on the cellular level and on the atomic level and on like the sort of human level where like people are having a picnic and then like the solar system and the galaxy and so on. I mean, like the problem is that you know, like it's structured like a zoom, but there is no actual zoom lens that could show all of that. And there's also no position on the Earth where you could, you know, get outside the Earth and see the solar system and then the galaxy and so on. I don't know. I mean, it seems like in your work, I mean, like there's both this insistence on quite distinct levels of reality, but also like a sense that it's not that difficult to move between them. So could you talk about that? I mean, about, you know, getting from one level to another?
You're talking about the distinction at the same time, the interblending?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, the interblending is part of the actual movement of why the parts function. Not the opposite, but the interblending is part of the total motion that animates all the functions and creates, again, the concertizing of reality. And it is so powerful and immense that we can take our minds and take a separable part and create a world out of it, and then do a number on our minds where we say, okay, well, that's a lesser part and that's a greater part. And so if you continue to do that, or if you continue to practice in that way for 500 years or 2,000 years, you tend to think it's something that is natural, or it's the only way that one can do something. But we see that there are other ways of handling reality, other civilizations, other type minds that are available to show us that, you know, there's more than one way of coming or approaching a system of contacts and a system what I could call a system of respiration, you know, because nature is a natural respiration. So again, the surrealist or someone like Antonin Artaud or somebody like Aimé Césaire. I mean, you can, in other words, they work with nature in different ways around that quotidian principle. So in other words, you open up other angles and other roadways, you know, other ways into the kingdom. And for me, that's the way that the inner blending works. You know, it's not just one way, but looking at another angle so I can begin to put this concert together where I can make it like a new garment or something like that. It's never been done before. I hope that answered.
I think kind of on that level, I wanted to ask you about your modes of research, because besides having like a kind of astounding vocabulary, you really in your work, like you're saying, and like Aaron was kind of talking about, you're hitting on various different traditions, different modes of thought. I mean, you could be, you know, in many ways you're a highly syncretic writer. You know, you bring together a lot of things. But, and as Stephanie said in the first half of the show, if you can read your work and if you got a dictionary next to you, you could use, you know, one can see that it's highly precise. You're not just throwing out terms and you're not just throwing out concepts just to spice up, you know, your work, which means that takes a lot of actual research and actually knowing what you're talking about when you're referencing something. So talk to us about how you go about doing research, how it affects your work, or how your work even affects what type of research you're doing.
Yeah. Well, it is that quantum reality of back and forth. It's not one way or another way. But for me, interestingly enough, once you get into that zone of awareness, I think everything is grist for the mill. Everything is open for research. I was looking at this article on Albania one afternoon, and I was in the shaft in my room, and there was this light coming in like a diffuse ray, and all of a sudden something opened me up, and it was this situation about Albania, and I began to write it, and it came out a poem about Enver Hoxha, the actual dictator of Albania for many, many years. Now, this, for me, originally was this whole idea of traveling around the world instantaneously without moving, physically moving, but actually projecting in the mind across these spaces into another alien reality. And to look at this as part of the looking into the strange for the sake of the strange, nothing else. And so it was like something I'd never heard of before in terms of Albania, and never really seen anything written on it as such, not in a poetic sense, at least to my knowledge. It could have been things or have been things written before that, but it just seemed to be a way to go, you know. And so this is something that I've always looked at in terms of the range of the mind. So I go into research sometimes consciously when I need to read something, but it's like Cortazar says about real reading for, you know, from your existential need, not to create a certain kind of cocktail party dossier. This is, so in other words, you're not a sophisticated researcher as such, but you research by necessity. And so sometimes I will find things like the Dada, just opening up the dictionary and just starting to read. And that leads to something else. But as long as you're on the scent, you begin to find things at different levels from all sorts of informations, if it's astronomical or biological or you know, in terms of, you know, the study of the pelagic, which is the open sea. You know, I've done all of that type of research. And so it's whatever it interests me, you know. Like with essay writing, I started writing essays because I, in a nascent way, wanted to get a camera and begin to take pictures. but I'm not very, how can I say, drawn towards machinery of picking up a Pentax or whatever and going out and shooting. So I figured I just shoot this way by looking at things that interest me in reality and writing an essay on it. And that's how I got to that. So I would, if I want to do some research, like I did an essay on Charles Fourier, I mean, I needed to go into that and learn something about that. You have to learn and be specific about what you're wanting to talk about, or, you know, something that's coming up. So you do research in that level, but also there's this instinctive reality that comes in where you also have facts, but they aren't garnered for maybe a particular project.
Any other questions in the audience here? I think Amar.
This touches on your on the research aspect of your work.
Mm-hmm.
You have, it seems like you have a lot of interest in Asia and the East, both theologically and conceptually, in terms of notions of planes and thought. And I was wondering where that interest came from, if it was maybe circuitous or random, or maybe more concerted on your part.
Well, thank you. I've always had this omnivorous, you know, wanting to just look at everything I could get my hands on. And I'd studied Sri Aurobindo and the Sufis and Buddhism, and I was always interested in this plane of the mind, because there was never like in Buddhism, there's it's a psychology rather than an open and shut door. So the fascination is for me endless, you know, in these cultures, because, you know, it's we're talking about, instead of 200 years, you're talking about thousands and thousands of years. So when I did the poem on Tibet, you know, I got into the animals, the comprehensive reality of the religious ceremonies, the types of tea that they drank. So all of this contributes, you know, to the whole. And as Le Bonfoy was talking about Miro, he says that when Miro switched from this type of realism he was doing in Spain to this other leap that he started in Paris in 24, the cosmic was missing in the earlier work. And so he had to redraft or rework his energies, you know, because something was missing. So the point I'm making is, when I want to get everything in, where I feel a certain completion where nothing is missing. So that can be, you know, something on weather. It can be something on cuisines. It can be something on mysticism. You know, it could be a person or an animal. It's the whole planet that we're talking about, and beyond it, which is part of it.
But you mentioned also before that you like to travel, but not actually leave, right? Like, you travel through your work. And so I was wondering how much interacting with people in those, like, veins, or, like, how does that work for you? Like, do you go seek out people to talk to about Tibet, for example, or as opposed to actually, you know, going there?
Mm-hmm. I talk to interesting people, and you know, one interesting person attracts another interesting person. There have been some key figures in my life that I've had along the way, and one of them I dedicated the novel to, Jim Henderson, who was very instrumental for me because of the discussions we had at that time. I was 21 or 2 years old, 23 maybe, And I was talking to, you know, these older gentlemen, you know, about these higher levels, and they had had more experience with this than I had, but it was very crucial for me, and especially with him, because he was part of this pan-planetary thinking. And so once you have this pan-planetary thinking, you know, no subject or no area is off limit to you. So you become a continuous, you know, adventurer in the spirit. So it's a challenge, too. I mean, if there's something like scientific or something about genetics or something about, bird travel or, you know, migration or things like that, that can be challenging. But there is a shorthand. Miro discovered a shorthand, and I discovered this right brain shorthand, you know, for speeding up the work. So I go get essences, you know, a certain time. And you get the essences, and that's what the imagination is for, is to ascend the fragment into a hold. So that's what research does for me. It's kind of like a spur. It's not a restriction, but an opening for me. Yeah.
Did you want to read another short piece?
I'll read a short piece. It's from the again the Stratospheric Canticles. It's called the Psychotropic Squalls. To peer into the obverse. Into smoking cane field erratums, as if haunted with the steamy colitis of whirling iridium cancellations. As in the saliva of newts, one sees the intestinal raging of deltas, of blackened sea giraffes osmotically split into simultaneous alums above a judgmental sea glistening with rictus. Like a weakened neutron egg, its fissioning petrol mirages like signals of irregular hunting geese flying through flames of ulcerated smoke and gargantua, hissing a blank imperial greenness rising above dense jetties of cobras. The shocking demise of the sea, the unlivingness of its winds scorched by irradiations of shaking brine incisions, the burning gulfs of sun with a glint of explosive Mandaean utopias, shocks against Old Testament linear prophetics of Jeremiah or Ezekiel, or the bony frozen fingers shaking stunted alchemical missives from a moon-burned Judea. No more than a mechanically burning moat focused on smoky spellbinders disruptives where the motion of the soul is delayed, reduced to flattened agnostic secular smoke, to a terrestrial rage which eliminates its sensuous heavenly fires, its stunning unreplicated angers, its sudden selenium spirals. Its fire which staggers across the pseudo-fault lines of pre-replicated judgment, its flirtation with spirits of enriched draconian plankton, so that the soul with its amber of flashing microbe drachmas, with its wounded tourmaline divisibilities flaming within a light of smeared tornado weathers, within a shower of black fish scales and spleen, is entombed within a blank, thirstless psychomotion, falling from a furnace of stars which both flares up and freezes, which inculcates a flawed microbial botany, as in hypnotic grammatical emulsions. Within a hollowed elliptical opening where we witness old Egyptian surgeries, where the dead magically rise up from mages and stare in a language of scorching totemic anomaly, spawned in heretical miniature, their phantoms seeping from quadrilateral sutures, from brief, violent, renunciatory squalls, uprooted, armed with the weaponry of ghouls and broken birch tree lizards, seasoned by the light of psychotropic angles, blazing in the middle of a green Venusian interior god, singing as if in the fumaroles of anguish with an inclement bleeding with a littered corona of unstable altimeter reverses.
Um, I was just thinking while you were reading that as well, more again along the lines of Aaron's question about moving from kind of detailed spots, you know, focusing in, onto a, not even, it's, I never feel like you're necessarily giving me a description of some action. And this is maybe where, your response to Amar's question, kind of folds in, but you are really kind of describing states of mind. This is a prescriptive statement myself, but
mm-hmm.
but it's, I found it interesting in reading your work, the kind of state of mind I would get in while reading it, because a lot of it isn't driven by direct action, and yet in it there's all kinds of direct action. There's radiated winds blowing across brines on seas and stuff like this. So I guess I found that interesting. I guess you've kind of already talked about this, but talk to me about that mode of writing. As opposed to, could you do this, or would you be interested in doing this in straight plot type, plot driven type work? Or,
well, for me the plot comes out rather than existing as a superimposed condition
structure,
or a structure that one has to fit into.
Sure. Yeah.
So it comes out just kind of like a tree would emerge with from the seed, with all the roots and all the circumstances of the tree that whatever creates a tree is there within the seed. So it comes out. So basically, this is where the automatic writing comes in at, because and I'll say this on record, it does actually work.
Yeah.
It does work. And I know there's this whole thing of, I know Breton had several minds about it, but I found that his original manifesto actually works for me.
Yeah. Huh.
And that's why I can get so much done. And the thing is that it pours, and it's accurate, and you trust it. Now, there are, things that, rather than correcting something, I'll hear it again. I'll just say I hear it at a different level. And that's why it goes fast, and you don't have to do many corrections on it. You don't have to linger over the text, and you're on to the next subject. You're done. You're actually, you can move straight through like that. So it is a right brain situation. So it removes the ego as much as possible.
Well, there was a book that you photocopied for me and sent to us, and it was like short stories. It was all really, really short stories, mostly.
These tales. And,
I can't remember. What was the name of that?
Arcane Lavender Morals. Yeah.
I was really taken by that, and I think that's kind of, I can't remember when that came out, but it was like early 90s, right? Or
yeah,
late?
Middle, about 94.
Okay.
Yeah.
And those were real, they were short stories, there were plots, and yet and maybe this was more the question I was trying to get to, is what amazed me in those stories is there was there was action, things were happening, and yet I never felt like I felt like it was different than some of your writing, some of your other writing in a way, but I still feel like I was on the same planes,
This is one thing I learned from the musician Eric Dolphy about moving from one instrument to another, from one genre to another. Yeah, you have specific areas of reality that you have to deal with in terms of a play or an essay or a novel or a poem. But the energy that's going through those levels is at that same level of animation. And the particulars of the project, of course, create the differences and the different pulls and tensions. But the same energy is doing the same thing all the time. And that goes for the drawings, too. I just finished a group of new color pieces that's coming out on the Spite and Dival.
Right.
Yeah, it's called Compression and Purity. It's the handwritten text. And we're going to, I guess one can order that online, from Spite and Dival. But it is coming out, and that's how I draw, at that kind of level of intensity. In fact, the automatism in the drawings is pure is as pure, more pure than even the writing. Huh. It's the same plane, but even when you're drawing lines, it's immediate. It's like music, yeah. You know. And so I just go directly in. There's no backtracking in the drawing. It's like I'm on Japanese rice paper.
You're not erasing.
I'm not erasing. Yeah. No.
Yeah, I have a question. So energy and suns and the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Before we came here, we talked about the energy crisis
mm-hmm.
that industrial civilization has gotten itself into, and sort of hoping that we could open that issue up here and talk about it in terms of poets and poetry and writing and placement of that practice in these times.
Yeah, I think it's very important for us to look at those areas as creative individuals, because we're conduits for not only like a reportage of those areas on one level, and a transmutation of those, that reporting on another level, and a communication with the whole of humanity on another or third level. So I think it's very necessary for us to look in terms of the whole environment out of which we exist. And this is not an environment where I feel, this is my feeling, you're not looking at a planet that's based on rhymed cadences at this point. I mean, you just are not. I mean, it can be a older technical exercise, of course. But it is, I know there's be a lot of disagreement about this from certain quarters. But if you look in a newspaper and you read the stories out of Iraq, you read the stories out of anywhere on this planet at this particular time, and you see a general erosion of the human condition at any point, across the globe. And, you open up the papers of record, the LA and the New York Times, and global warming is official. So we're talking about a limited oil supply that was given to us. And now we are coming to the end of it. I mean, we have Alan Greenspan talking to the Senate a couple of weeks ago. This was a little portion in the business section of the paper now. Not some poets read, but it's something that you're looking into the area, and he's in certain ways saying that United States, you will never be a factor again in this oil market, because our supplies have gotten to dangerously low levels. And this is something that I know that the political parties maybe around the globe won't acknowledge, And I know the Chinese are going absolutely crazy about looking for oil because they've turned themselves on to this post-industrial, this society of building and making and doing, and there's not enough oil. And there's riots every day, and they bring out the army to quell the people in different parts because there's no energy. And they're going, that's why they wanted to buy Unocal here. Yeah. So these are important things to kind of take a look at, because say, his name is Kunstler, James Kunstler. The Long Emergency, very important book, because it talks about what the American consciousness is doing at this time, sleepwalking through this period. Because everything from hot dog wrappers to microphones, to what we're talking about, are oil-based. All our products are oil-based. So, and how are you going to run a society when you lose contact with your source? So that's for poets too. I mean, your source is this energy that's coming out of you. So you want to look at your tendencies, look at your particular vibratory impact, and begin to work with language in that response. So you can create a whole field for yourself. So now we're dealing with competing factions for less and less. The Koreans compete, the Chinese compete, the Americans compete, the Russians compete. Everybody's competing for less and less, and trying to do the same thing where it's canceling itself out.
And just recently, I've heard various critiques of like political writing, directly or indirectly political writing. But I do think that over the last 4 or 5 years, I think writers have turned more towards sort of direct political engagement in their writing.
Mm-hmm.
And from a couple different camps, I've heard critiques of political writing similar to, it's like the old critique of 70s political art. Oh, it's, you're just being bombastic, or you're just being shocking to make a point, or, or whatever point you're making will be easily, swept up by, the mainstream culture and turned into a product.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, why are you writing about this? Why aren't you out in the street doing something? But, which I think is an easy, I'm presenting the critique probably in an easy way to knock down, but mm-hmm. but I wonder what you think about various critiques of political writing, or how you feel, that's something you're interested in, or...
Well, political writing is very, in other words, you have to feel your subject. You can't talk about your subject.
Right.
When I was doing the poem on Tibet, I felt that subject. So it felt quite natural for me to combat the quotidian energy of what Mao was doing in other words, he was destroying poetry for me. So I could feel that as part of one of the monks. So, that's how you feel about something, is the generated energy that you have in it, rather than just talking about something because it's in the wind. I mean, there's about 7 zillion poems written right after the Iraq invasion. It was a knee-jerk response, this is back to Benjamin Peretz talking about the dishonor of poets when they just write political work that doesn't move interior space. It only commits to a momentary vocabulary. And it's quickly overcome, and it doesn't deal with the true feeling or the true danger of what real work is about. So,
you read the last piece, and we'll know that'll be it.
I'll read a few pages from the Exobiology as Goddess, and this is the goddess of the. She's the goddess of not only the terrestrial world, but the cosmic world as well. And I have a quote from Northrop Frye. And he says, "The poet, like the pure mathematician, depends not on descriptive truth, but on conformity to his hypothetical postulates." And this is Exobiology as Goddess. Her range and katabatic ash dispersed across my strange nomadic hearing, alive as bleak metabolizing voids. And she is alive inside this bleakness with her pure acidulous powers as autic speculation, as a conclave of serpents, as doubled migratory winds, as one time persistent solely to Eastern Asia. She is mirage whose aura is wattage. A blue-white glow with homoseismal lines welling up from her sluices like earthquake patterns, or a cunning solfatara creating for my perusal a flight of invented demons. Then summoning from her sound a compound of ammonia and gravity, palpable as burning electrical transition, its ciphers condensed as a compound intransigent species. As goddess, she floats through sudden methane harbors, angling dust from the seeds of the moon, revealing herself as huerta, as pomegranate, as an iceberg calved from glaciers on Uranus. On nights when the sun whispers, she emits her form through reflection, as though created from odor, from hyperabyssal rocks, her sound now sunken to the seabed with all its auroral fires. The impact of a voice more disturbing than a gramma of blizzards or a rigid portion of broken tabula mass. The solar concavity then hovering in a voiceless anti-rain as a pointless electrical fuel, its green totalic mist suddenly synonymous with Solea, with her broken dromedary plantings, with her treasonous infertility, her voice grafted with perplexities, with ironics hidden in a floating neural vacuum, in intergalactic hissing warrens so as to announce her full effect is far beyond treacherous monotony or snow. She remains the dark, unstable onus, the black treaty as balance, flying apart and burning, being mirage as congelation, as formless tributary pony, algid, biting, ingenerate. Aroused in one zone as an elemental leopard, in another as reversal of simums of amber, alive as percussive obsidian shale, as fluid which dwells at the barrier of ether. I call her the Chaldean seamstress, forging hominids from darkness. And from Arabian blue deserts, she emits her tonality through deafness as perfect fruit acquired by agenda, so that matter does not transpire as her optics of Rosa. Therefore, she generates topography through combative meridians, through storks of drift, through isometric deeds, as if in the breaking of ice, her voice created bells, created arteries of vapor suspended over three or four terrains, spliced through distance as motion. We interact as presence within presence, as spirit twice its equal in spirit, so that a range of beasts burns between us, perhaps a skewer or a cormorant or a platypus. Perhaps our haggling is a claw which scalds with radiation, with philosophical half-torment, so that we hang from one another like scattered alkaloid forms, like floating gestural plankton, her void oblique with transmutation, with molecular half-boundary, so that our substance rise between the X-ray at its minimum and the sound which combines an atmospheric dioxide. I, the woven corona of lightning, and she, the scope of ovarian transmission. We combined as a precipice of morals, always obsessed by blank, progressive, spasmodic. Perhaps we are the jungle inside the moon which irradiates Antarctica. Perhaps the ghost from Kerguelen scallops, like the fire which exists above the transantarctic mountains. Her being a singular dweller in these boiling tectonics, I can say that her biology projects from a typographic haze, esoteric and minus the broken forms from eastern Antarctica, an unrivaled domination as her glare, now a spinning optic krill, now a clashing dialectic of apogees. So we mate in our typographic fishing boat at the opposite condition of swamps. There then exists contrast, and true monotony is plague.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Will.
Thanks a lot.